From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
What?
Do they know I'm black?
Should they?
You might wanna, you know.
Mom and Dad, my black boyfriend will be coming up this weekend. I just don't want you to be shocked that he's a black man.
That's the beginning of a trailer for the movie Get Out, released on February 24th of this year, and currently totaling $111 million in sales. Some have described the movie as being Guess Who's Coming to Dinner meets The Walking Dead.
So you guys coming up from the city?
Yeah, we're just heading up for the weekend.
Can I see your license, please?
He wasn't driving.
I didn't ask who was driving. I asked to see his ID.
Get out.
Sorry, man.
Get out!
Yo!
There's too many white people. I get nervous.
No. No.
Danny Haifong is a weekly columnist at BlackAgendaReport.com. His column this week is entitled, The Most Important Lessons of Get Out, Expose the Ruling System in Its Totality. We spoke with him via Skype Sunday.
Well, Get Out is about a young black photographer who is dating a white woman, presumably a white liberal, who invites him to her parents' house. And what ends up happening is a number of events from the moment he arrives at his girlfriend's parents' house to the very end that represent a sort of a rude awakening for him about the true character of white liberal racism in the United States, something that you understand that he has a pretty clear understanding of, but what he goes through from, being touched and being revered over and having all these white, affluent, liberal Americans, fawn over him all the way up until he ends up, strapped to a chair,
in the basement.
In the basement to prepare for a procedure that would...
A brain transplant.
Exactly. That would, in effect, condition him to be a loyal servant to these very white affluent families who supposedly are supposed to be quote-unquote allies of him and black people generally. It's very satirical as well.
Yeah.
It sort of frames the absurdity of white liberal racism in just the horrific character that it actually manifests itself into in real life. So you really get a good feel as to what not just black people go through in so-called mixed race relationships, because a lot of this is confined to interpersonal relations. But the film does a really good job as showing that white liberal racism, this so-called colorblind racism, is just as violent, just as horrific and damaging as, whatever one may conceive as right-wing or overt racism or however one may call it. So, I decided to write an article about it because I think that in this period, a lot of people are going through a very similar process in a broader sense when we're talking about the larger system of U.S. imperialism.
You know, it comes out of the propaganda machine here, and you mentioned that it's received critical acclaim from moviegoers and critics across the country. Maybe you could parse through a little of that.
Yeah, I feel like the movie, surprisingly, I think that there are some things within it that make it a little more Hollywood just Hollywood acceptable. For example, he doesn't end up killing his white girlfriend at the very end. He ends up just leaving and letting her die. So there's some little things that make it acceptable. But in the broad sense, I feel like a lot of people, especially people that I trust in just the so-called movement community, they really sort of embrace this film because it's probably, even Jared Ball, for example, is calling it as good as it can ever get on a Hollywood film screening about something like slavery, quote unquote, which there's a lot of references to in the film. And so,
well, I got to say, though, coming from Jared, that's a pretty loaded term because, you know, as good as it's as good as it can get could be like, you know, 0.006 on a scale of 1 to 1,000,000, you know, and it would still be accurate. And he kind of codes things that way sometimes, you know, by speaking just completely literally accurately, you know.
Right. But it's a, you know, it's a pretty interesting film, to say the least. You know, my critiques of it would be that it still confines itself within interpersonal relations. So the institutional, you know, the institutional mechanisms in which racism works can still be kind of hidden if you're not already familiar with the way that institutional racism works. So that's one of my critiques of the film. But I do think that there's this broader message of how we really need to be conscious of the way in which, as you said, the what appears to be a lesser evil actually is just as evil, if not more effectively evil, in, you know, the U.S. political landscape. And so my article that I talk about, what I talk about in my article is this, you know, development where I think millions of people are going through a similar process as the main character of the film, where he slowly but pretty deeply finds out that white liberal racism is just as violent as any other form of racism. I think a lot of people in this country are figuring out, and recent poll numbers show that a lot of people understand that the Democratic Party is just as malicious as anything that's being doled out right now in the GOP / you know, Trump administration reign at the moment.
You know, so, I mean, it's like comparing the circles of hell one to the other for, you know, for their lack of hellness or whatever, in a way, because, you know, okay, here we have, as a metaphor or example of white liberals, protagonist, who is the young black photographer, gets taken, you know, both in and home to the parents of this white woman, this liberal-minded, you know, she's in love with him, and we're all equal, and come on and meet mommy and daddy. You know, if she were an overt racist and they were overt racists, he'd never end up there. But instead, he ends up there with his guard down and essentially in a room full of people in the basement that want to take out his brain and put their own brain in his body. It's hard to say which is a worse condition for Chris. and I guess that's the metaphor. You know, you've got either the, you know, the crackers that have been in charge, you know, large parts of the country, most of the history of the country, you know, overt segregation and all of that. And the white liberal version, which is like, well, you know, you could live next door because it's a lot easier to cut my lawn, you know, you don't have to drive as far and I don't have to pay for your gas, which is kind of the way that a lot of people see that. This all happens in the context of, you know, I mean, this film and, you know, the little historical sketch that I just constructed happens within, of course, the, you know, existing conditions present in the United States, which include the continued and intensified division of the working class along race and with the complication of identity. I'm wondering, like, I mean, clearly the media across the board, including Hollywood, have been addressing and stoking that now for a few years rather aggressively. And you're seeing a division become sharper and sharper in many areas of the body politic. And I'm wondering what role this film is intended to play by the people who are, you know, getting it out there, distributing it, maybe who funded the production of it or whatever. And then maybe also what kind of role it could actually play in the midst of all of that.
Right. I think, you know, when it comes to the film's intention, it really speaks to the political context that we're living in, because I think that the filmmaker's intention was to really illuminate experiences that he has had, Jordan Peele, for example, that he has had in, you know, in this milieu, this white liberal American political space, where racism is just as much in the language and in the behavior of that particular segment of the population as you said, the crackers, the right wing white section of the population. And I think what it could, in terms of what the film could actually do to the benefit of building a real radical political alternative in this time, is to provide a message that can be broadened, because at this point we're looking at some deeper questions, some bigger questions that relate to this this phenomena of how racism is built into the system that we live under, built into imperialism, not merely it's not merely acted out as a separate institution from the system, but actually it is deeply ingrained in it. And I think that, there's a lot going on right now in terms of just discontent on the ground among large sections of the population. I think a lot of people in different ways are going through their own get out process, where things like, half of the world's wealth and more being concentrated in the hands of six individuals, and how a lot of those individuals, contrary to what Rachel Maddow might think, none of them are named Vladimir Putin, but a lot of those individuals are Democratic Party supporters. And if we look at what the Democratic Party represents, it is not just the umbrella of black political leadership at the top, or unions and labor. It is also the party of white liberalism. And we see that white liberalism is connected to these billionaire capitalist elites that have really created an existential crisis for the party, as well as the crisis that exists on the ground for millions of people. And, I mentioned earlier the poll that shows that the Democratic Party has the worst popularity rating right now, right, than Donald Trump himself. And given the attack that the Trump administration has received from the corporate media, that's pretty staggering.
It's amazing, actually. One of the roles that white liberals have played, and it's been more and more perhaps evident as the vector between word and deed has widened, is that they act as arbiter of this, almost as the analyst, or those providing scientific weather vaning of where racism lies. They point essentially, and especially in the last 2 years, 3 years, at the white working class. They did that both with Trump voters, but they also did it, as you recall, with Sanders voters too. Mm-hmm. So white liberals get to point at these people, those who the racists are, not at the class that is riding this whole structure, that has still in its hands the original wealth taken from the original genocide and the original enslavement of millions of people, all the profits from the cotton industry in the 18th and 19th century and all of that. That money's still on a pile, and there's still people that own it. It may not be exactly the same people, but it's definitely the same class. Mm-hmm. They're never pointed at by these people. The big threat, the source of fascism in the United States, the white working class. Can't make unity with them. It's impossible. And even those on that call themselves on the left and in the vanguard of the left say that repeatedly as a mantra. They will also say, and it's the system. Mm-hmm. But in terms of the real essential problem, which is unity of the class, it's not even on the table, because part of the class is seen as the repository of white supremacy.
Yeah, exactly. And that's a deep problem that has existed for decades, arguably even during the period of the so-called New Left and the anti-war and anti-imperialist movements. There was really only one organization that understood that, and that was the Black Panther Party, that you really have to, if you're going to wage a liberation struggle for a particular group of people like Black America, you're going to have to build allies wherever you can find them. And the working class white population in the Appalachia area and in cities across the country was one of those efforts that the Black Panther Party undertook in order to build a stronger organization and a stronger source of defense in order to withstand the repression, and as well as just the difficult conditions that existed on the ground for millions of Black people. And I think that, you know, right now, the biggest challenge to any sort of working class political ideology sprouting from these conditions of chaos and crisis is the Democratic Party, and is this notion that, you know, white liberalism has really deeply ingrained in the United States, that there is a way to, there is a way to move forward under this system of imperialism, monopoly, capital, and that is to just rid of Donald Trump and his appointees, and everything will be fine. And I think that this is becoming more and more apparent to millions of people that such a solution really offers nothing. What it offers is merely a regime controlled by the Central Intelligence Agency and an alliance of the Democrats and Republicans, who ultimately have placed the millions and millions of working class people in this country in this predicament that they're in. So we see that I think a lot of people are going through their own get out process, and I think it's important to even watch films like the one that we're talking about, because what it shows is there is a political situation happening on the ground, similar to the elections, where discontent is kind of driving this conversation into effect. And we, as radical leftists, as radical organizers, have to be ready to broaden that message, deepen it, and make it something that people can take hold of and use for political activity. And, unfortunately, when we're too caught up in this anti-Russia hysteria or this, dump Trump mentality, this complete focus on the individual, we miss that. And I think Get Out has a good message about, you know, understanding that racism, white liberal racism, is not about any individual. It's about a confluence of interests.
Yeah, you know, one thing that might help get there is to distill to a simple message. I'll go back to the analogy I was making before, and say that the problem, you have the white liberals pointing to the white working class as the repository of white supremacy, but in fact, the working class in its entirety is a victim of it, including the white working class. And the beneficiaries then, understanding this, become, they become visible, they become apparent. It's obvious that if the working class is the one getting the raw end of the deal, well, then all of the value is flowing to that class, the bourgeoisie. And the party political game that gets played, I mean, it's symbolized there with the Democrats playing the role of, and also being the home of, but not exclusively anymore, the white liberals. Because they're also joined by the neocons and a whole bunch of other folks in the Democratic Party now, just about everybody but the white working class.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. That's sort of the dynamic that's going on here. And I think that there's a big challenge ahead for people who consider themselves movement activists, organizers, and intellectuals. And I think that challenge is to articulate, you know, a program and a path forward that can really address these intractable problems, as well as give a lot of what people like Mao Zedong and Lenin used to do, give a real understanding and view into what is the class makeup right now in the United States, and what is it like in the world, and how do we approach certain issues. Because, you know, if we just get into this baiting game with working class whites or whoever we think we disagree with, like, you know, a good amount of Trump supporters or Bernie supporters or whoever it may be, if we get into this game of arguing with, well, how could you have voted for such a man, or, you know, Sanders is not good enough. If we get into that, we're not looking at the particular challenges that drive people to do things like vote a particular type of way. And I think that we really risk alienating a lot of people in a moment where such alienation could lead, given the balance of forces in the United States government right now, could lead to a civil war we've never seen before, where on the one hand you have Democrats and Republicans of the establishment variety trying to get anyone they can under their tent, and those who supported Donald Trump on the other. And that's I think that's a very dangerous scenario that, you know, we have a great potential to avoid, given that on the ground a lot of people are looking for a more workable and a more beneficial alternative, and just don't see it or have it at the moment. And you know, it's our job to get there.
Yeah. You invoke both Lenin and Mao in this, and it's interesting because what you're talking about essentially is taking a look at the forces on the ground now, and also the you describe with talking about Trump, people behind Trump and people inside the Democratic Party, and also you could throw in there the people that are tailing behind the liberals in the streets right now. That's a galaxy inside a universe. The actual universe is that you have, say, the people that support Trump, the people that oppose Trump, and then about half the rest of the population who aren't involved in that particular aspect of it at all. A very, a small number of those being activists with, a deep ideological interpretation of reality that brings them there, and others just complete, rejection of the entire system without articulating a particular ideological perspective as they do that, other than this is all garbage, just, there's nothing in that for me. Lenin took the idea that the working class was going to lead the revolution, and realized that the conditions that Russia faced at the time of the revolution in 1917, and he realized it early and articulated it, of course, that the peasants also had this revolutionary potential, even if they were not ideologically prepared, perhaps, and he spoke to that some too, in a way that you could also apply, by the way, to white former factory workers in the United States now. And also at oppressed nationalities. And then, Mao looked at not just bringing them in, but having the peasantry lead.
Mm-hmm.
And so, the situation in the United States is different because the level of industrial economic development is, much further than the feudal state that existed in Russia, or that which existed in China in the late 40s. But there are still realities here that need to be articulated first, scientifically tested, and then analyzed, and then of formulations presented, and I don't think anybody's doing that except in the back room with data, and I'm guessing that just Trump and say the DNC have that information processing in front of them. What do you see looking across the landscape here?
Well, I think, to kind of sum up what you just said, I look at things like this growing and fermenting war with Russia that the United States ruling class is trying to wage with the Democratic Party and some close GOP allies as the driver, as a potential issue, a striking point where we as a radical left, or we as organizers and activists, can really illuminate this landscape, get it out of the get it out of the data rooms and the the data scientists for the bourgeoisie, and get it to the get it out to the people, where we will really see the stark difference, the stark antagonism between the, you know, immiseration of millions upon millions of people in this country and the very forces that create that situation. And I think, you know, looking across the landscape, we have a challenge where we do have a society and an imperialist system in this country that was founded and developed on structures like racism. And we have to be ready, racism and war, and we have to be ready to, when all of this ends up jumping off, which is very real and a very real, it's a very real scenario that could happen, war with Russia or another capitalist crash or both, that will send millions of people ready to fight in some form. And we will really be able to then take on these challenges, such as the deep division within our class, the class division that ends up taking form out of conditions of racism and war, and begin to forge an alternative that can, you know, upend and uproot all of these forces, the entire ruling class and the entire ruling system that creates the problem. And I feel like that's why it's so important. And, you know, people like Margaret Kimberly and others have made it such a point to not let up this fight against the Democratic Party and its GOP allies that, you know, may oppose Trump on the surface or may oppose Trump on very critical issues that ultimately we should be taking a deeper look into, but do not oppose the continued exploitation and oppression of our class. And I think that's really what the movie Get Out symbolizes for me, is this awakening period.
Yeah. You know, and finally, you close with the fact that it was not just the Reagan and Bush and prior administrations that have been doing this nefarious work, but that Democratic administrations, including Clinton and Obama, were behind the intense escalation of racial oppression and exploitation in the late 20th and early 21st centuries. You talk about Clinton, you know, destroying welfare and ending welfare as we knew it, militarizing the police very intensively, and immigration enforcement, including constructing a lot of the architecture that exists now, and, you know, a huge change in the direction of mass incarceration upward. Now, a lot of the architecture for that and the implementation of it under Bill Clinton.
Exactly. And these things can easily be ignored if we get sucked into this narrative that Donald Trump, the individual, and the Trump administration as a whole is ultimately the only force that we should be even looking at, that we should be investigating, because if we don't begin to look at what's going on as a systemic problem, a problem of the entirety of the U.S. imperialist system, then these nefarious characters in the Democratic Party, which in effect really is becoming completely transformed by its own contradictions into just another wolf, as I talked about in my last segment with you. We really won't be able to do things with some of the more interesting developments that are coming out, not just the film that I talk about, but I also talk about the recent WikiLeaks dump, which is huge, talking about how the CIA, which is allied with the Democratic Party, basically creating and, having a program itself that basically does exactly what it accuses Russia of doing, hacking into computer systems and then reattributing it back to the very very hackers or countries or whoever it was
the
CIA stole from. You know, we're talking about really deep intractable problems and contradictions that are becoming so apparent that we're really going to miss an opportunity if we get sucked into this notion that that Trump is the only force at work right now.
Danny Haifong has a regular column at blackagendareport.com. This week, the most important lessons of Get Out: expose the ruling system in its totality. Danny, thank you very much.
Thank you, Don.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.